the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program, broadcasting to you live today from Dallas, Texas. And we're going to have an interesting conversation with Jim Wallace. He is the founder of the Sojourners Community, well-known in the media. He has been known as something of a gadfly in terms of American Christianity, especially prodding conservative Christians as he's offering another alternative to what he sees as the religious right. That's really what he's all about in his new book entitled The Great Awakening, subtitled Reviving Faith and Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. Now, it's going to be a fascinating conversation, and we're going to invite you to join us. And I just want you to be ready to hear from someone who may challenge some of the things that that we take just as a matter of assumption. And we're going to have a good conversation about some of those things that may divide us, and some we may also share in common. That conversation coming in just a moment. First, to review some issues in the news, let me just mention to you that at my website at albertmohler.com, I published a couple of articles in the past 24 hours or so. One of them has to do with what I call a gift from literature, which brings a worldview clash into view. And what I write in that article is that no one should underestimate the extent to which fundamental worldviews produce very different understandings of reality. And I want to point out that one of the differing understandings of reality has to do with what history tells us. Christianity comes with an understanding of history, and just to consider the importance of this, just remember that the biblical line of history is horizontal. It has linear progression. It has a past, present, and future. It has a beginning and an end. Eastern views of history are very different. Cycles, endless wheels of time. Repetition of events over and over again. Those represent two very different understandings of reality. But let's just go back for a minute to understanding time as linear, past, present, and future. Never a moment is repeated, no cycles, just time passing from beginning to inevitable and eventual end. Even then, there are a couple of different ways, fundamentally different ways, to look at the trajectory of history. Some see it as always going towards progress. Things are just getting better and better all the time. As a matter of fact, the Western idea of progress, Western meaning Western civilization, has been very much a persistent temptation. And one of the things I point out in my article is there's some fairly good reason for this. If you're looking for evidence on many grounds and many fronts, just think about medicine. 100 years ago, you died from a whole lot of things you don't expect to die from now. There's no doubt that the development of vaccines and CAT scans and all the diagnostic tests and surgery, antiseptics, anesthesia, all these are really good things. There's no doubt that we should celebrate many of the facets of high technology that have given us so many of the things we now enjoy and take for granted. Modern transportation, as a matter of fact. Modern hygiene. There's a lot of good things. Modern forms of government. I don't think any of us want to go back to Caesar. We would rather have representative democracy, which is an altogether fitting comment on the day known as Super Tuesday, when about half of Americans have the opportunity to vote. But when you look on other fronts, the picture doesn't look so optimistic. It doesn't look like progress really works. I mean, for one thing, at least 50 or 100 years ago, we assumed that families were probably stronger than they are now. Marriages before no-fault and easy divorce were stronger than they are now. Families probably had more time together than they do now. So you can start looking at a lot of things, and you could also look at the whole pattern of secularization. But the view of history and its direction has a lot to do with who you are and what you believe and what drives you as a worldview. Now, explaining that just as we've been discussing it will make sense to a lot of people. It will give some prod for discussion and maybe some reflection. But literature has a way of getting to the heart of the issue in a way that this kind of conversation might not. So I want to read to you, and in fact I've mentioned it on this program before, I think for the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, but just listen to this again. It comes from Cormac McCarthy's novel, No Country for Old Men. In this passage, one of the main characters reflects on this clash over the direction of history and what it means. I'm reading to you from the novel now. Here, a year or two back, me and Loretta went to a conference in Corpus Christi, and I got set next to this woman. She was the wife of somebody or other. And she kept talking about the right wing this and the right wing that. I ain't even sure what she meant by it. The people I know are mostly just common people. Common as dirt, as the saying goes. I told her that, and she looked at me funny. She thought I was saying something bad about him, but of course that's a high compliment in my part of the world. She kept on, kept on. Finally told me, said, I don't like the way this country is headed. I want my granddaughter to be able to have an abortion. I said, well, ma'am, I don't think you got many worries about that the way the country is headed. The way I see it going, I don't have much doubt but what she'll be able to have an abortion. I'm going to say that not only will she be able to have an abortion, she'll be able to have you put to sleep, which pretty much ended the conversation. Well, that might be a conversation stopper, but boy, that little narrative, that little picture from literature, and this from a fairly recent novel, helps to encapsulate this clash of worldviews. And you may notice the same clash when you're in conversation with a coworker, with maybe even a relative or a neighbor, when you're watching something that goes on in the news. Let me give you one way of looking at this. For instance, let me just give you another vignette from something in fairly recent politics that may bring this into relief. Back during the confirmation hearings of now Chief Justice John Roberts, one of the key issues was the direction of history, in particular the history of the law. And Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy, Edward M. Kennedy, stood up in the well of the Senate and asked publicly whether Mr. Roberts, now Chief Justice Roberts, would buy into the view of history in which he said, we are moving on in the absolute and continual expansion of individual liberty. In other words, on abortion, euthanasia, and other issues, Senator Kennedy sees history moving in the direction in which all those things will eventually be, as abortion, now made legal simply because that's the way freedom makes history go. Obviously, there are others who hold a very different understanding of history, and it is just interesting to have that reflected in literature. I published another article in the last several days, this one in my column known as The Reading List. I mentioned the book by Peter D. Kramer, entitled Freud, Inventor of the Modern Mind. It's interesting. I'm here at Dallas Theological Seminary giving the W.H. Griffith Thomas Lectures in Theology, and I'm speaking about the new atheism. But you can't talk about the new atheism without talking about the old atheism. And Sigmund Freud certainly reflects the kind of atheism that really drove much of the 20th century. And, of course, Freud really did have a massive impact on how we view what it means to be human, especially his understanding of the interiority of the subconscious. Let me just read to you from one paragraph of Peter Kramer's book I mention at my website at albertmuller.com. He writes, it is impossible to imagine the modern without Freud. Consider a single area, and he just mentions literature, and all these authors that had to assume Freudian thought in order to tell their stories. He says this, even after the limited modern era of the last century, we remain Freudians in our daily lives. We discuss intimate concern in Freud's language, using words like ego and defensiveness. We listen and observe as Freudians. As others address us, we make note of telltale incongruities that simultaneously hide and reveal unacceptable thoughts and feelings. That goes on to say when those things are demonstrated, of course, what do we call them? Freudian slips. Well, you may find that interesting, and I think it's important that Christians understand the shaping of the modern mind. That's why I direct you to Peter Kramer's book. I think it really does help to understand Freud. Other issues in the news include the fact that we have the upcoming Lambeth Conference of the Church of England, and especially the Anglican Communion, calling together Anglican bishops, archbishops in particular, the heads of the national churches from all over the world. According to Ruth Gledhill of The Times, that major London newspaper, the Anglican archbishop in charge of drawing up the document intended to reunite the warring church said he believes that schism can be averted in spite of divisions over the issue of homosexuals. And listen to this. The archbishop of the West Indies, the Most Reverend Drexel Gomez, said that a new formula had been found that would allow the disciplining of errant churches while respecting the traditional autonomy of the 38 worldwide Anglican provinces. Urging all Anglican bishops to attend the Lambeth Conference this year, he said it would be a tremendous tragedy if the church fell apart. Now listen to this. Remember that you're talking about a church, the American Church, the Episcopal Church USA, that has defied the communion, that has brought an absolute division, Anglican against Anglican, and now Archbishop Gomez says that a new formula has been found that would allow the disciplining of an errant church without fracturing the entire communion. But listen to what he says here. He indicated that the Episcopal Church of the United States was unlikely to face discipline or any form of exclusion from the Anglican Communion as a result of its consecration of an openly gay bishop. In other words, this is the typical kind of way a religious bureaucracy responds to controversy. Say you're doing something and don't do it. Say a way has been found to discipline a church, and then when a church does everything right in the face of the communion to beg for this kind of discipline, he goes on and says, well, it's unlikely any of that would actually happen. That's exactly what explains the entire breakdown in the Anglican Communion. Forgive me, but while I'm here in Texas, let me just say, it just reminds me of an old Texas motto. It's a put-down when you say that someone is all hat and no cattle. It looks like that's what's coming in the Lambeth Conference. Back with a conversation with Jim Wallace about his book, The Great Awakening. It'll be fascinating, and we'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Jim Wallace is the author of the new book, The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith in Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. Jim Wallace has been our guest on the program before. It's always a fascinating conversation. Jim, welcome.
Thanks, Alan. I'm glad to be back on your show. Thank you.
Well, it says something about life in America today that a guest based in Washington and a host based in Louisville are talking from Dallas and Los Angeles. But here we are.
There's globalization for you.
Well, you've got your book out, a lot of fanfare. Let's set the stage for a discussion, and let me just ask you to tell us the thesis of the book. Why did you write it? What are you saying?
Well, politics is broken. I think most Americans feel that. 70% of us think the country's going in the wrong direction. And when politics fails to address the big issues, the big moral questions, what often happens is social movements rise up to change politics. And historically, the best ones always have spiritual foundations. So I've been doing research, Alan, this whole notion of great awakenings in our past when faith revival happened, and it changed big things in a society, like the abolition of slavery and women's suffrage and child labor law reform, civil rights. And the church historians tell us, I've learned, that when spiritual activity and renewal, only when they change society does it get to be called revival. And so I've looked back at those first, second, third, fourth Great Awakening, and now I see a whole new generation of young Christians. I talked to the Wheaton Record this morning and Relevant Magazine, this new young evangelical magazine. They're applying their faith to the big issues, like the moral scandal of poverty, environmental degradation and the threat of climate change, a consistent ethic of life, which talks about wherever life is threatened, from the unborn, the poor children, 30,000 kids who died today because of poverty and disease, Darfur, human rights, all those areas are important to them, and the cultural assault upon our families and kids. I'm, an older dad with a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old and a Little League baseball coach, and I'm appalled by the stuff that our kids get thrown at them every day. So all these agenda items,
right,
HIV/AIDS and pandemic diseases, these are concerns for young evangelicals. And I think politics, both sides are failing. The left and the right are both failing to resolve these big issues. And I think it's time for another great awakening. And I see it all over the country, and I'm very encouraged by a new generation especially.
You know, I have to say, I find that very interesting. I want to go back to the idea of awakenings for a moment.
Sure. Uh-huh.
Because as a historical theologian myself, to go back and say, I think the origins of those were in a very clear recovery, the preaching of the gospel.
Exactly.
A moving of God in the churches that led to conversions to Christianity, mm-hmm. led to a reawakening of authentic Christian discipleship.
That's right.
And undoubtedly that did lead to the political mm-hmm. and cultural change, but are you also concerned to see that kind of awakening in the churches?
Absolutely, and after the book tour, we're beginning something called Justice Revivals, and we're going around the country, starting in Ohio and city by city, and I'm an evangelical, I always have been, and the writing of this book and the praying and the vocational discernment all got tangled up nicely in the writing of this book. And I'm feeling called more than ever to be a revival preacher and to be talking about, coming to Jesus, coming to faith. and the kind of faith that really translates in the, like I love Charles Finney. You remember Charles Finney from your historical work. He was the Billy Graham of his day, and he was the Second Great Awakening, early 1800s, and he preached Christ, and people came to Christ. And then the altar call he used to sign them up for the anti-slavery campaign. I talk about Wilberforce, of course, a wonderful story of this British parliamentarian who came to faith in the Wesleyan revivals, and through John Newton and some others, and the movie that we all saw this year, Amazing Grace, and how that movement of faith led to the abolition of the slave trade. People of faith have done these things before, but they're not just political movements. They're not just social action. They're a call to faith, and then a faith that explodes into the world with explosive power.
Now, I lost track reading your book. How many times you used the words spirituality and faith? Just define those two for me, so we make sure we're talking about the same thing here.
Well, I'm a Christian, and for me, I'm an evangelical Christian, in fact, and for me, it's faith in Jesus Christ. I wrote a book called The Call to Conversion several years ago, and I'm going back to that again and again. And chapter 3 in the book talks about, the gospel is a new order. Jesus Christ calls us to the kingdom of God, a new order in the world, and the church is meant to be a new community in that world. And it's out of that that we begin to, take on the specific reforms and change, hold the state accountable. But the role of the church is central in all of this. Now, there are also people I meet around the country who've been turned off to religion, but they're still hungry. They're spiritually hungry, and there's a hunger for spirituality out there. And so they're I meet them too. But, I get really excited, Al, after these sessions when people come up and say, I read your book and it brought me to faith. What's next? What's next? Or someone say, I was an activist before, and I agree with you on some of your issues, but now I feel called to faith, a faith that can sustain me in this work and change my life and not just change my neighborhood and my country. So I'm going to be preaching the call to Christ in these justice revivals, and there'll be people there who are maybe been lapsed in their faith, maybe have left the church, gone away for a while. Maybe they have a kind of a vague spiritual hunger. It's some of that stuff's kind of vague and new agey, but they'll be called back to following Jesus Christ, and that's what I'm going to call people to.
Jim, let me ask you another question
here.
And we come from some different places. That's what makes conversation interesting. But
sure.
On page 9 of your book, you come right out and say that the era of the religious right is over. As a matter of fact, that's in the subtitle of your book. Basically, you believe that.
What I mean is that the monologue of the religious right is over insofar as it's a dialogue now. And they're still strong in the party, but even there, I spoke with Family Research Council this past year, debating Richard Land, who's a friend of mine, who gave me a nice comment for the book. Richard and I disagree on some policy areas, some substantial ones, but we're friends, and we worked together on Darfur. We went to the White House together on Darfur. Immigration reform, number of issues we work together on, and what I want to see is a civil, Tony Perkins and I had a good conversation before I spoke at his meeting about where we can find some common, agendas. The former speechwriter in the White House, Mike Gerson, is now a Washington Post columnist, Mike Gerson, and he's doing a great job, and we've been on different sides of some issues, but we've been having lunch, finding common ground, having conversation about mutual concerns. One is poverty. Fighting poverty should be a nonpartisan issue and a bipartisan cause. The book talks about how conservatives have good ideas on this, and liberals do too, and we have to combine the best ideas and then transcend them both and get some results done. So, I think the monologue is over, but a dialogue is better than that. So a number of us are wanting to have a conversation, how to get results, how to make a difference, and that's a good thing.
Jim, we got to go into a break here.
Sure.
You'll be with us in the next segment as we discuss your book,
to.
The Great Awakening. And there are some good things to discuss here. And when it comes to suggesting the need for dialogue, that's why we have Intelligent Christian Conversation to join us. You may have a call question for Jim Wallace. You may have a point you want to raise. Call us at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Coast to coast and with listeners around the world. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Our conversation today is with guest Jim Wallace. He's the author of The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith in Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. We've been having an interesting conversation. In just a moment, I'm going to tell Jim what I think is the most difficult challenge posed in his book, a challenge for Jim and his movement to answer. But before that, I want to tell you about the first time I heard Jim Wallace speak. And Jim, I don't know if you remember this or not, but it was in Louisville, Kentucky. It was back in the early 1980s, and you followed Robert Schuller. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. I do.
I just have to say, you and I agree on some things, disagree on some things, but that was one of your greatest moments. Actually, I don't mind saying right here on radio that Robert Schuller got up and talked about the gospel of self-esteem in one of the most troubling messages I think I have ever heard. And you had to follow that, and you did, and very effectively, I have to say. So that was my first exposure to Jim Wallace.
Well, and, I remember that. I remember that was a very significant. Well, I'm glad you were there.
Well, we've both been a long way since then, as a matter of fact.
Yeah.
But here we are in 2008 having a conversation about your new book. And I got to tell you what I think is going to be your greatest challenge,
mm-hmm.
Jim. And I do disagree with you on some of the policy proposals, and you won't be surprised by that. But here is the nexus of what I think the struggle is, not only for you, but for many others. On page 27, you write, clearly part of the work to be done includes teaching religious people how to make their appeals in moral language and secular people not to fear that such appeals will lead to theocracy.
Right.
Now, that word theocracy, it gets thrown at us all the time, because what we mean is that there are biblical values that we believe ought to be reflected in public policy. But you're really calling for public reason, public rationale here, a non-theistic, non-supernatural, non-revelation-based argument. And I understand that. That's the great challenge for us. But I'll tell you where I think it gets really tight. On your chapter on abortion, you talk about the tragedy of abortion. And I appreciate the fact that you recognize there is a moral tragedy in the death of the unborn. How do you even talk that way without running the risk of, sounding like a theocrat?
Well, you know, I think what I'm speaking to there in that second part of that quote is there are many on the left who have been hostile to any kind of raising of religion in public life. Richard Land and I talk about this a lot. Richard Land says, Jim Wallace and I agree, faith has a place in public life, and he thinks the success of his book and mine mean that the secular fundamentalists have lost. That's what Richard says. We'll see if that's true. But they certainly come at us with any mention of faith is to flirt with theocracy. And I just don't agree with that. I think I believe in that there ought to be a separation of church and state, the old Baptist idea. But the segregation of moral values from public life is a mistake. And I think it is possible, it is necessary, as Martin King evoked Jesus and Jeremiah and Isaiah, with the Bible in one hand and the Constitution in the other. And so what I'm saying there is our convictions are motivated by faith, not by just moral concerns or secular values, by our faith. And when we get to the public square, we can't say, well, I'm religious, so I get to win. It's a Christian country. No, we have to win a debate. We have to show that what we believe is the best thing for the common good. So King had to show that civil rights law in 64, voting rights 65, were good not just for Baptists and Christians and believers, but for all of us, for all Americans. So we have to show that, too. That's what I mean by putting it in moral language. But we are motivated by our faith. Then we have to make a moral argument for what's best for the common good. And I think on the abortion question, we have been stuck in this debate that goes on for years, yet the abortion rate never changes. It just never changes. And so I think we've got to really press hard for a dramatic reduction in the abortion rate. And I think even those who say they're pro-choice, I'm pro-life, but those are pro-choice, even they, I think, could agree, some of them should agree, to doing the things that we know that really dramatically reduce the abortion rate. I was in California, a mom or a woman stood there at the book table. She says, my daughter's graduating from Harvard. And I'm so proud. Because I teach her part-time, I thought that's why she was telling me. I said, it's a great school. You should be proud. She said, but I was a single, low-income mom when I got pregnant. And if I didn't have food stamps and Medicaid, I might have aborted my daughter, and a tear came down her cheek. Tell people that. Tell people they got to support low-income women like me to provide alternatives to abortion. And I think we can do that and offer that to a country that needs to move ahead on reducing abortions.
Jim, thank you so much for joining us today. Jim Wallace is author of the book, The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith in Politics and Post-Religious Right America. Give us a call to join the conversation at 877-893-8255. This is the Albert Mueller Program.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mueller Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back again to the Albert Mueller Program. My guest, Jim Wallace, who is the author of the new book, The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith in Politics in a Post-Religious Right America. You know, with most books, I have an ongoing conversation. And, Jim, I'll admit, with yours, it's all marked up. I circled, I underlined, I wrote things.
Good.
Marginalia. So I had a debate with you before you were even here, and obviously some points of genuine agreement as well. Let me just ask you, you know, here, let's say you're talking to an audience that has a good number of listeners who are conservative Christians. What would you say? What is the great exhortation that you'd want us to hear?
I would say that we can't fall into just the political categories of left and right. Those are not religious categories, but political ones. And I think if Christians who have been divided on some issues could come together and find an agenda, a common agenda, where all our values were really engaged, I think we could shake up politics. Tim Russert, his Meet the Press party, he told me that. He says, you know, if you and some of your friends on the religious right come up with an agenda that really was inclusive of the 30,000 children who died today again because of poverty and disease, that those poor children and unborn children are both in the category of the vulnerable who Jesus told us we have to defend. On Darfur, on AIDS, on human rights, on the environment, so many things that we could do a common agenda that would really challenge the left and the right and really shake up politics. If we were Christians first, before we were left or right or anything else. And the book talks about don't go left, don't go right, go deeper. What are the moral choices and challenges right beneath our debate? Let's not have a religious left to fight with a religious right. Let's talk about a new moral center in this country, not a mushy middle or a soulless centrism, but really a moral center which says what are the moral challenges here. That's what revival's done before. Great Awakenings have done that, pulled us together across all these boundaries. Let's try it again. Let's do something.
All right. Jim, thank you so much for joining us and for just being on the program today. Good conversation.
God bless you, Al.
All right, folks. When you start looking at the whole question, and there are a host of questions raised by Jim Wallace's book, you really have to know that these books, these proposals and discussions, debates, arguments, they come in an historical context. And it really is interesting to note where we are in this current context. We have gone as a movement of evangelicals from a lack of political engagement to a lot of political engagement. And, of course, we've also had the experience of seeing the debate over who is an evangelical, what evangelicals believe, what should be an evangelical Christian understanding of various issues. Jim Wallace has been a part of a movement that for a long time has been styled something, first of all, the young evangelicals. Back, that was a few years ago, as time rolls backward there. Then of the kind of the evangelical left, and he's been associated with anti-war movements, with anti-poverty movements, and a lot of things generally associated with the left. And I got to admit that, as I said, I had a debate with his book. There are a good many points at which in the book I did find substantial disagreement. For one thing, even in his understanding of the revivals, you know, the most important issue of these historic revivals were that they were spiritual awakenings that had a particular understanding of individuals coming to faith in Christ, had a particular thrust, which was the gospel of Jesus Christ, that began with the sinner's need for redemption through the shed blood of Jesus Christ before getting to what it means to live as a Christian. But, of course, it did get to that. And that's why the Great Awakenings did reshape the country. By the way, I was talking with a Canadian historian a few years ago who said, look, if you want to look at the difference between Canada and the United States, just consider the fact that Canada never had what America experienced in the Great Awakenings, and so never had the kind of institutions and Christian culture that really were built up around those movements. Now, the theologian in me also has to say, when you look at some of these revivals, in particular the Second Great Awakening, you have to wonder whether there was any long-lasting spiritual impact in terms of the churches. In fact, church historians are very much involved in a debate over what that really meant. A debate, by the way, centered in the very man that Jim Wallace mentioned, Charles Grandison Finney. But that's for a different discussion at a different time. I want to come back and say that I think what Jim Wallace is about in this book is about pushing the evangelical movement, maybe pulling the evangelical movement away from the list, what he would suggest is a very restricted list of concerns generally associated with the religious right. And it's not just away from just that restricted list of concerns, but toward a different way of engaging them. For instance, on the issue of abortion, he says we should move beyond trying to criminalize abortion and should instead work at the social structures that are deeply involved here in order to make it less likely that a woman would want an abortion. Now, to his credit, he does acknowledge that the moral status of the unborn child is important. In fact, he uses the word tragedy about abortion. Let me just point out that, again, if you're going to speak that way, then you're invoking a moral language that many Americans simply will not understand, that nonetheless I think is profoundly true. On the issue of homosexuality, and in particular of homosexual marriage, he says that he does not favor homosexual marriage, but he does favor absolute equality through civil unions. And, you know, I look at that and I want to say, you know, if we had several programs in which we could be involved in this conversation, I'd have to devote a considerable amount of time to trying to figure out where that logic leads. Because it just assumes that equality means absolute civil rights, including the rights for the equivalent of marriage for persons who are involved in homosexuality. That's a huge jump. In other words, you're accepting an identity politics there concerning homosexuals, whereby they are now to be understood as deserving the same kind of protections as those and rights the kinds of civil protections that are accorded persons who otherwise would be discriminated upon the basis of race or gender or ethnicity. Now, that's a huge jump. That's a jump I think most evangelical Christians are not going to be willing to make. Going back to the issue of abortion, you know, as I read Wallace, I really hear Reinhold Niebuhr. And one of the things you need to know about Reinhold Niebuhr, a major figure in 20th century theology, is that his most important book was entitled Moral Man and Immoral Society. And the assumption there is that people are basically good, but the structures of society are basically evil and then lead people to do those things that are not good. That's what I heard in the background of Jim Wallace on abortion. People are basically good. They wouldn't want abortions, except they are caught in this web of social evil that leads them to do what they otherwise wouldn't do. Well, Niebuhr was half right and half wrong. He was absolutely right that society is immoral. The problem is, he was wrong that human beings are basically moral, that is, inclined to the good. I think that's one of the biggest challenges I'd have to address to the idea of Jim Wallace and his book, The Great Awakening. But today we started a conversation, and that's exactly what we need to have, a respectful conversation about issues that matter. Back with final thoughts in just a moment. This is Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. Our guest today was Jim Wallace. He's the founder of the Sojourners Community, also the author of the new book, The Great Awakening. And it was an interesting discussion. It's the kind of discussion that really gets us started, but doesn't get us to a conclusion, because these are not issues that are easily discussed to conclusion. Not certainly in an hour, not in a week, not in a month, probably not in a number of years. But I do think there's something to be learned from this discussion, and that is that, of course, we can always talk about broadening our moral horizon and our sense of moral responsibility. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important to have conversations with people like Jim Wallace, because he does force us to see some things we otherwise might not see. Now, one of the major calls he makes in his book is for Christians not to be co-opted by any political party. Now, there are some that need to hear that warning in terms of the left and the Democratic Party. There are those who need to hear that in terms of the Republican Party on the right. I am concerned for evangelical Christians that we develop the kind of political responsibility that reminds us that we should look at every political party as a part of Genesis 3. That is, in a fallen world, political parties are about what they see as to their own best interest. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't involve ourselves in the kinds of activities that are party-oriented. It doesn't mean that we do not support candidates and vote for candidates. It does mean that we keep our eyes open and we keep our powder dry, so to speak, understanding that all political alliances are by definition temporary, because our concern with an eternal perspective is for issues and persons and truths that really cannot be prized and owned by any political party, and if so, not necessarily even for the right reasons. That's probably a good thing for us to remember on this day when 24 states are holding primaries or caucuses. About half the American people are going to be voting today. It's probably a good thing for us to remember in terms of the limitations, but also the responsibilities of politics, as we reflect on the fact that an awful lot of the post-voting analysis tonight is going to be about whether or not we now have, on the Republican side, a presumptive nominee, and on the Democratic side, a continued race for the Democratic nomination. There are big issues out there. The issues are too important for any of us as citizens to ignore. But we as evangelical Christians, believing in the gospel, have a particular responsibility to think through how these issues relate to our responsibility. Our goal, after all, is not merely to have a winning candidate or to come up with a winning strategy, but first of all, to think about that which would bring God greatest glory, and to think about our first commitment, which is to Jesus Christ and his gospel, and then to those whom Jesus loves, as he told us to love our neighbor, also in terms of our responsibility. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about what's on your mind. It'll be Ask Anything Wednesday, a live broadcast from Dallas, Texas. I'll see you then. This is the Albert Miller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.